So we already know that on Sundays we've been looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. We are starting to conclude chapter 4 as we begin to prepare to get into chapter 5. In verses 13 through 16, what do we see there? What are we able to find there in verses 13 through 16? What literary device have we been able to see there? What is Koheleth doing there? I'm sorry? A warning? Kind of, yeah. It's an allusion, right? He's alluding to something. And what are we seeing so far that he's alluding to? Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. Joel?
He was wiser in his youth than he is in his old age.
So he's alluding to the past mistakes of his life, right? He's alluding. In fact, we can even say that he's lamenting, right? He's lamenting that in his case, he was going backward, right? Normally, the way our world operates, the older we get, the wiser we should technically become, right? Life, experience, and so on and so forth. They contribute, of course, as long as we are willing to use, right, our past experiences for that purpose. But in the case of Solomon, right, in the case of the king, unfortunately, he was wiser when he was young. He understood his limitations, he was humble before God, and he had a stronger faith. He was more faithful to God than when he came into his old age. When we read Ecclesiastes 4:13, to me personally, humbly, it brings forth 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1. Can somebody please turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 3 and read it for us? 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. Thank you, brother. So what snared Solomon, as we've read in those three passages, right, was what? His lack of love, right? Or we can say his diminishing love, right? Solomon, if you compare him to the church at Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2, Solomon had forgotten his first love, hadn't he? He had forgotten his first love. We know that Solomon loved God. We know when we read about the 1,000 bulls that he brought, right? The 1,000 burnt offerings that he brought in honor of God, Jehovah God, that shows how much he loved him. We see and we read about how in his youth, in his early years as a king, Solomon was devoted to the law. He loved doing what God's law said. But along the way, Solomon, along with his knowledge, right, he became puffed up. And that love that was so strong and that love that was so full began to reduce and it began to grow smaller. Now, it's interesting because in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul says this in context or in reference to what? What do we know? What are we very sure of according to that passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 8? We know that idols are nothing, right? We know that idols are nothing. We know that eating meat offered to idols is not going to contaminate us, right? We know that everything related to idolatry is, well, superstitious. But notice that Paul is bringing this up because he's saying just because we know that they are nothing doesn't give us allowance or permission to do or partake in actions that can harm someone else, right? We're not granted permission to mock those who perhaps are still offended by it, right? By the practices. Well, I find it interesting because it was very likely what snared Solomon. He knew that those idols were nothing. So for him, it's like, well, they're just statues, they're just dolls. I know that they don't, I know they're not God. I know the real God. I've spoken to the real God. I don't see how it's going to harm anyone. If it pleases my wife, well, you know, very likely Solomon was the one who invented happy wife, happy life, right? Unfortunately, his life was not as happy as he thought he would be when his wives were. So notice, right, how as he's reflecting, looking back as a young king who was upstarting, who was devoted fully to God, whose zeal was strong and mighty in honor of God, he would have never even thought about it, right? Think about the fact that with his wife, the Pharaoh's daughter, when he was building the temple, he put her separate from it, right? He separated her from it. That shows the type of devotion and zeal that Solomon had for God. That he wasn't even trying to have her ways or her customs, perhaps, that she was still battling with, to want to influence, right, the priesthood of the house of Israel. But now in his old age, he built them in Jerusalem, the city that was supposed to be God's, right? So as he's looking back, right, whether it's the inspired writer using Solomon as the character study, right, or the character of this poem, of this play, as we've said before, or whether it's Solomon himself who's writing these words, the reality is that he's looking back at the tragedy of how somehow, somewhere along the way, his love for God began to diminish. He had forgotten his first love. Brother, I know you had raised your hand. Brother Kevin.
Idols talk to him. None of them did anything. How does a person who is rational, he wasn't crazy, not understand the genuine versus the fake? I can't wrap my head around that.
You know, that's the conundrum, right? I think all of us always ask the question, a man as wise as Solomon was snared by idolatry, right? Joel?
Well, I think 1 Corinthians kind of where it says that it gives way to arrogance. And I think that's what his folly was, his arrogance, that he started thinking, well, I'm almost like a god, that I can give this to you, and that I can supply this for you.
That's an excellent point, right? He became his own idol. He became his own idol. And it goes, again, I've used this expression before, Solomon was too smart for his own good, right? But it serves as a warning to us. Self-righteousness, brethren, can truly make us become fools. In the case of Solomon, very likely he made himself believe that, well, I can find a way in which I please God and still not become. So as we go back to Ecclesiastes 4, notice in verse 14, for he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. Now, it's interesting that he says this, right? Because again, he's alluding to something. But here's the question. Is he still talking about himself now? Is he still talking about himself? Or does he now have someone else in mind? Let's read verses 14 through 16. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and grasping for the wind. Is Solomon still talking about himself? Or Koheleth still talking about himself? Or has his mind now gone elsewhere? Okay? Let's focus on a moment on the content. What is he saying here? He's still reflecting, right, on the way time works, doesn't he? And remember, after verse 3, he understood, I'm not in control. I'm not in control of the amount of years I live. I'm not in control what kind of day I'm going to have. I am not in control even of how many hours we have in a day. All of that belongs to God. Chapter 4, because of that, when he returned to himself, remember, he begins to see around him. And he begins to contemplate what things oppress us. And he begins to contemplate basically all the things that makes joy in this world temporary. If you paid attention to the common trend in chapter 4, right, is that all these things he's brought up, they all target joy. These things are all events that sour how much we enjoy whatever success or whatever pleasure we're able to obtain here in this world. The oppression, right, of selfishness, greed, envy, jealousy, all of these are found in chapter 4, aren't they? And now, as we go back, he's now looking at the fact that nature itself becomes an oppressor and stands in the way of our joy. How does nature itself do so? Think about the clue that Brother Kevin, right, mentioned. So when I got here 9 years ago, there was no Noah or Kezia, and there was only a little Anna who taught me how to say candy in sign language. Okay? Now that same Anna is on her way to being a teenager. Scary, right, Joel?
Very.
But think about that. Anna, at least to me and her parents especially, right, along with my receding hairline, are a reminder of how quickly time moves. Because you hear 9 years, and those of you who've been here, very, very patient with me all that time, very likely the first thing that came to your mind was, has it really been 9 years already? Man, Obed's been here for 9 years already? It doesn't seem like it. It does not seem like it. When I first arrived back in May of 2015, when you all first met me, Memorial Day weekend of 2015, I was 30 years old. Here I am now standing before you at the age of 40. In May of 2025, it'll be 10 years since we first met. How did that happen? How did that time move so quickly? You know, those of you who are parents, you look at your children and then, you know, they have their own children. For those of you who are grandparents, seeing your children have children must be one thing, but then seeing your grandchildren be grown and then they're talking about having their own children, I can only try to imagine, but I wouldn't be able to, right? Look at what Koheleth is talking about here. He's looking at his youth, now as an old man. And as he looks at verse 14, for he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in the kingdom, I'm not the same man that I was at the beginning. It's been eons ago since I was that man who grew up poor in the kingdom. You know, there are some who make the suggestion that perhaps here Koheleth is alluding to Joseph. And it fits, right? Verse 14 fits that it could be Joseph. I mean, Joseph was born poor. He was sold into slavery. He was bought, and he became, right, a manager, we'll call him, of a house, right? But then he was wrongfully accused and he was imprisoned. But then he was entrusted with the guard, the guardianship of the prisoners. And eventually, well, he became a ruler of the most powerful kingdom at that time. It fits. There are others that make the statement that perhaps Koheleth is alluding to Moses. And alluding to Moses when he had fled to Midian, right? And how from that poverty and from that state from where he was called to be the deliverer. But you see, even though those fit, we cannot say with certainty that that's what he had in his mind, can we? What we can say is the reason why he's bringing these thoughts up, which fit within the context of what we've been seeing. If you read verse 15, after he's reflecting of the passage of time and after he's reflecting on how quickly things move, verse 15, I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. What does that mean? Earlier, Brother Kevin, said, you know, that popped out to you. It's time for you to see it like this, right? So what comes to your mind when you hear that?
I don't know. I see it. It jumps out, but I can't really place it. I'm really struggling with that.
Okay. Juan, what do you think?
I'm thinking he's seen everyone in his kingdom and seen the next generation come up.
Very good. The second youth, or the second child. It's not the first. Who does that remind us of? I submit to you. I'm sorry?
Great grandkids,
right? But I submit to you that he's alluding to the first generation that came out of Egypt, the Exodus. Because of the fact that the first generation did not enter into the promised land. It was the second generation. Notice how he follows it up in verse 16, right? There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Could the second generation rejoice in Moses? He delivered them, but what did Moses not do?
He did not enter the promised land.
And he did not conquer it with them. Who ruled them and who led them into victory?
Joshua.
Obviously God, right? But we know that Joshua was God's chosen man. Joshua was the second leader. Joshua was chosen as Moses' successor. And as a king, not talking about Moses, we're going back to Koheleth, right? As a king, in their old age, what are they always thinking about? What is one of the most important things that they have in their mind as they grow old?
Legacy
and or the runner-up or their heir, right? Their heir. The heir is the second child, the one who's going to take my place. You see that? Yes, Brother Joe.
Two things. On that last part, it says, you remember, I used to do this. I used to, but no more. And what I get out of this three or four verses here is advancement without God is useless. Because So he said, I invest a lot. He did. But whatever he did, it went down the drain because he did not include God in his plans.
So notice, right, verse 15 and verse 16. Again, verse 13 and 14, he's reflecting about when he was a young man, how he's gotten to the point where he's at. I'm going to read verse 15 and 16 again. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stand in his place. We're all going to be replaced one day by our children, aren't we? We're all going to be replaced one day by our children's children. True? So what that says is, I saw all the living walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. He's looking at the transition of one generation, which is his generation, to the next generation, because he has no control over how or what identity that next generation is going to take on, does he? You know, I was saying to, I don't remember who it was, probably my beloved, I was telling her, the Lunch Fellowship last week, when one of our young people didn't know a certain artist, and my jaw hit the floor. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know who that is? And I was telling Leah, I'm like, you know, I now understand my dad. I remember my dad having reactions that way, and I remember my dad saying certain things that way, and now I understand why he would react that way. It wasn't my ignorance, it was the fact that it was an indicator of, man, you're old. You're old because there's now a generation, right, that has risen. You ready for this? Who did not know Joseph. You see why many think that it is Joseph that he's alluding to here? There rose a generation, says Exodus chapter 1. There rose a king who did not know Joseph. Stephen in Acts chapter 7 also brings this point up. And obviously we know that what is referring to is that king overthrew, according to historical records, right? He overthrew the dynasty that was in power. And it's another way of saying that he refused to acknowledge or recognize what Joseph had done for their kingdom. But the idea is still the same. He made it his aim to erase Joseph from history. You know, brethren, what he's looking at here, Koheleth, as he's looking at, he still has what he learned about time in his mind. And as Brother Joe is saying, he's now realizing why teaching the next generation is so crucial. What are we teaching those that are coming behind us? More importantly, what are we teaching them as it relates to the spiritual, as it relates to God? Brother Joe brought up an excellent point. He's learning firsthand that life without God is vain. It's kaput, as he fancily said, right? But here's the problem with that. What did he teach his son and his son's son? How to live a godless life. Now that he's going to want to teach Rehoboam, if we are to accept that this is Solomon, right? Rehoboam has lived in adulthood following his father's example, where he's also trying to have all the pleasures of life, all the fame, right? So on and so forth. So as he's now looking at this, verse 16, there was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and grasping for the wind. Trying to control how the next generation reacts to my legacy, trying to control how to mold their future when I am no longer here and still have that impact and still have that influence over them, that is vain, he says. They're an entire different generation. who very likely most of them are probably not going to remember me. Why? Because they were too young when I was still alive. The only way I can actually make an impact is by doing it with God, through God, because only God is eternal. Notice chapter 5. You see, he's been setting us up this entire time to show us that God's influence and only God's influence lasts throughout all generations. Because God is the same yesterday, today, and forevermore. Right? What applied to the past applies to the future in relation to God. And it's amazing because Koheleth is doing this by realizing, wow, they had 24 hours eons ago, and we have 24 hours, and they're still going to have 24 hours. That was because God designed it that way. Everything that God does in every generation, it's immutable. So he begins to start counseling those that come after him. Notice how in chapter 5, verse 1 and forward, he's moving or shifting from reflecting to now advising from his own experiences, right? Pay attention to verse 1 and forward. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they do not know that they do evil. What did he not do in his adulthood? He didn't walk prudently, didn't he? In fact, he slipped. He slipped and he started heading downward, didn't he? So as he now has reflected and he's now looked at the world and the condition of it, and he's looking at those who are going to replace this current generation, he now is using the time that he has to start trying to create a dent in that generation, doesn't he? You see, a very important lesson that we learn here is it doesn't matter how late you start as long as you start. Now, it's better if you start at an early age, but if you don't ever start at all, that's the worst thing you can do. Notice how as he's realizing this and he's understanding this, now he's giving diligence to doing what he should have been doing this entire time. And the focus is on how you ought to conduct yourself before God. You see, in chapter 5, verse 1, yes, he talks about when you go to the house of God. But verse 1, he's speaking about the importance of reverence, isn't he? How are you approaching God? The way you enter his home reflects what you feel or what you think about him. So, this past week, my sister Nidia was blessed. She is now a naturalized U.S. citizen, thank God. But it was interesting because one of the things that they still do when they were going to, you know, swear them in, I think is what it's called, when they do the oath, right? They asked all of the men in the audience to please remove their hats. I was like, wait, come again, Nidia? She goes, yeah, they still do that. I was surprised. Those who didn't want to remove them were kicked out. You see verse 1? When you go into the house of God, you walk with respect. Go in with the right mindset. Understand the importance and the value of what you are about to do. He wasn't doing that, was he? In chapters 1 and 2 of this book, he wasn't doing that. He was going to the house of God because he had to. He was going through the motions, but where was his heart? Where was his mind? You know, I'm doing this because it's a political move. I'm doing this because, you know, God wants me to do it. But as soon as I'm done with service, I'm going to go back to building my buildings and sleeping with my women and partying and, you know, counting my money like Scrooge McDuck. Some of you probably don't know what that is. But pay attention to the fact that he now realizes it all starts with the house of God. That is where it begins. How am I entering into his own house? You know, in Oriental culture, the respectful thing to do is guests automatically know that you don't enter with your shoes on. You remove them. You know, there's a friend of mine that when I would go to visit him, he doesn't live here in Texas anymore, but every time we would enter, he'd like, hey, you know, if you don't mind, you can take off your shoes and you can put them right there at the entrance of the door. I had two choices. I can insult him and tell him I'm not taking off my shoes. You're crazy. I'll just go home. Or I can recognize it is not my home. I'm a guest in his home, and it's not important whether I'm barefoot or not. I'm there to spend time with my friend. How are we entering God's home? Question, what is the house of God today? The church. Someone go to 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3. And please read for us verse 14 and 15. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14 and 15.
These things write I unto thee, hoping to come unto thee shortly. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth.
Brother Chuck, what things did Paul write to Timothy before he gave him these instructions? Okay. What had Paul just written to Timothy about? Respect. Elders and deacons, which goes back to respect, doesn't it? Pay attention to that. We always focus on the key words of house of God, church, they're interchangeable. But again, let's respect God's word as he's given it to us. Let's look at the context in which Paul is doing this. These things, what things? The qualifications of deacons, the qualifications of elders, your responsibility as an evangelist to make sure that when the time comes to establish these men, these offices, you're establishing the right men and not just anyone. All of this shows respect and reverence for God's home, doesn't it? But respect and reverence also shows interest. These things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly, but if I am delayed, listen, Timothy, whether I'm there or not, you need to make sure that these things are happening. The responsibility is falling on you. You don't need me there. This is why I'm writing these things. This is why I'm helping you from afar by sending you these words. If I am delayed, you fulfill your ministry. You do your part. Remember who we serve. Remember in whose home we dwell. Remember where we abide, with whom we abide. See, brethren, we are the priests of the New Testament. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. Revelation chapter 1, verse 6, right? We are the priests of the New Testament. Here is why understanding our Old Testament is crucial. We should go and examine what the priests did in the temple that Solomon built. We should examine what the instructions were of the priest who served in the tabernacle, the respect with which they had to carry themselves. Every family had a specific designation, a specific job. None of the priests were left without a responsibility. And from those who had to build the tent and deconstruct the tent when it was time to move, to those who carried the Ark of the Covenant, every single one of them needed to do it with a great amount of respect. This is not our home. This is God's home. You know, when we go back to the book of Exodus, you know, I brought up my friend, and look at what God tells us to do, right? Look at what God tells Moses to do. Exodus chapter 3. We're going to read starting at verse 1. Exodus chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Oreb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. Then he said, Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Can you please remove your shoes before you come into the house? Leave them right there in the entrance. You know, I didn't ask my friend why. It's his house. You know, if I was wearing one of my socks that pokes one of my toes out, that's on me. That's why you got to make sure, Alex, and right? We got to make sure, Alex, and that we're riding, wearing the right socks every time. We never know. But I am in his house. When I speak to denominationalists and they're trying to impose or push their traditions, their beliefs, many times I bring them to this and I tell them, was Moses allowed to keep his sandals on because that was part of his custom? The answer is no. This ground is holy, and the only way you're going to be allowed to remain here is by removing the filth from your feet. During the week, how are we walking in this world? And when the first day of the week comes, how are we entering the house of God? Do we remove our sandals and leave them there at the entrance or on the outside? Examples that come to my mind is, do we walk in with the problems of this world, so distracted by them and forget that we are in the amazing and awesome presence of God? Do I bring in the baggage? Meaning, do I bring in the smelly sandals from the dung of the sheep, from being out in the pastures? You know, as we begin to wrap up our class for today, turn with me to James chapter 1. Yesterday, for those of you who were with us in our Bible study or in our evangelism class, you remember Brother Zach brought this passage up in class, right? But I want to start reading at verse 21. James chapter 1, verse 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. You see how this ties into what we're seeing with Koheleth? Before he can give the advice in chapter 5, verse 1, he needed to what? lay aside all filthiness and all overflow wickedness. It wasn't until chapter 3 when he lays all that aside that in chapter 4 he begins to see clearly. In chapter 5 he begins to do. 4 he gets clarity. 5 he goes into action. Our time is up. I know some of you are raising your hands, but we needed to get through this, so thank you anyways. But God willing, if it is his will, next Sunday we will pick this up. Please go home, read chapter 5 as much as you can, as many times as you can, so that when we come back together, we can study it together. Thank you all. May God bless each and every one of you.